What if it wasn't about the Garmin and they were just like putting their heads down because they were expecting the Ciccone sunglass toss and they were taking evasive action?
Welcome back to another episode of the Placeholders Podcast. Everybody, I'm Kaylee Fritz. It's Wednesday, March 22nd. We've got a great show for you today. Before I get into the actual show, a brief note about sort of the entire Escape Collective podcast network. I've mentioned this a couple times. I'm just going to reiterate. If you are subscribed to the Escape Collective channel, which is also the former Placeholders channel, you get all of our podcasts. You've probably noticed this. You get Geek Warning, you get Wheel Talk, you get Pretty Serious Bike Racing Podcast, you get this podcast. You also get the occasional extra deep dive like Dave Rome did with SRAM this week. It's pretty simple. If you want everything, you stay subscribed where you are right now. If you want just one of these podcasts, they all have their own channel as well. You can search those on whatever tool you use to listen to podcasts, and you can get them. Just a bit of housekeeping there. All right, we've got plenty to talk about today. We're going to talk about Shikon, which we had to actually look up how you say that, and we may not stick with it. Shikon and Mark Cavendish and Astana and that drama that has been happening, playing out over the last week or so. We're going to talk about Remco and Roglic at Catalonia, which is fun, and also the quite frustrating thing that they've been doing at finish lines, which I really hate. Johnny has some thoughts on Bruja de Pana, which was just this morning, and I think informs some, I don't know, some storylines and tactics going into the rest of the kind of cobbled classic season. We've got a Nairo Quintana update, and we have a pretty wild story that Ian reported and was up on the site last night from Latvia and the way that they're approaching their athletes racing with Russians, given the whole war situation going on over there. We're going to dive into all these things on the show today. Kate Wagner, welcome back.
Fala, from Slovenia.
You just finally made the move over. How's your new digs?
I'm good. I go to Slovenian school in the same school that like small children go to their language school, and we sit at tiny desks in brightly colorful rooms, learning how to say I go to Slovenian school. My name is Kate. Well, we're past that stage now. We're now more complicated things. Like today, like I had to write an essay about Primoz Roglic for class, and
you've never done that before.
So. I've never done and so I have to say my Slovenian writing has quite a bit to be desired. For example, I said that like kot osebo Roglic je prijazen in smishin, which is like, so as a person, Roglic is nice and sometimes funny. And my teacher writes at the bottom, said zabavin, funny. Smishin equals like a clown.
Oops.
So that's how Slovenian school is going. So
I wouldn't say Roglic is particularly clown-esque.
Yeah, I would say he's maybe the other end. Not at all.
Yeah, I think in a story this week I compared him more to the sort of the
Terminator,
Nick Offerman, Parks and Rec kind of comedian. Anyway, Johnny Long, welcome back.
Thanks, sorry.
Welcome back. My on Roglic, my favorite ever comparison of him was in a keep after, or Le Keep. After he lost the tour, they described him as a fridge freezer that developed feelings.
Oh yeah, I remember that. I got really upset by that. I got really upset by that, actually. But okay.
Was that who's the Le Keep writer that I'm thinking of? The big fellow, big blonde fella.
I can picture him. Yeah,
Alex, someone.
Yep,
Alexander Rus.
Yes, that's it.
He's fantastic. If you want, sort of, he's the natural successor to. Now I'm just totally blanking. Professor Snape. You know who I'm talking about.
Brunel.
Alan Rickman.
Yes. No, Philippe Brunel. He's the natural successor to Philippe Brunel over at L'Equipe. And if you speak any French or read any French or you just want to Google translate it, go look up an Alexander Rus piece from the Tour de France if you want to sort of get a real feel for just the way that the French journalism establishment writes about the Tour de France. There's nothing like it in American media. There really isn't.
And if you want to get a feel for how it was produced, just Chainsmoke throughout.
throughout the entire. You're going to have to finish like 3 to 5 cigarettes between the beginning of the piece and the end to really get a feel for it. Well, you just heard there, Ian Treloar. Welcome back, Ian.
Hello. Sorry to barge in. Just naming French journalists uninvited.
It's the vibe of this particular podcast. We're gonna take you behind the scenes of the French journalism establishment on a semi-regular basis, I think. Let's get into today's episode. So one of the kind of biggest stories of the last week that was outside the sort of immediate racing sphere, and we will get into, like I said, we're gonna talk about Catalonia and Roglic and Remco and all those things, was this Mark Cavendish Astana Chicon debacle. Johnny, could you sum it up for me?
Oh, crikey. As soon as it involves tech, my mind sort of goes blank. Interesting the pies are. But I have a grasp on it enough to explain. So Mark Cavendish arrives at Astana, Kazakhstan. And a problem arises because Mark Cavendish is sponsored by Oakley. He arrives. That's obviously a nice little Bunsen burner earner. So he doesn't want to drop that. Astana have their contract with Chicon, whatever. But they somehow come around to the fact that Mark Cavendish is still going to be wearing the Oakleys and will not be wearing Skycon. Skycon are very upset and it's all fallen apart. CEOs of Skycon are writing statements. I think Phil Guymon tweeted, he's like, oh, you're worried about the ethics of how they've treated this deal or whatever. It's like, your company's gotten into bed with Vino. It's like, this is not a big surprise that's been hatched on you.
I mean, we had mentioned previously that this might be the reason why it was taking so long to actually announce Cav, and I think that the way that this has played out suggests that that was probably correct. In addition to some of the terrible things he's been dealing with the house break-in and all the rest that were over the winter, it's pretty clear now that there was some attempted negotiations happening behind the scenes between Chicon and Cav and Astana and trying to figure out that situation. And for a while, Cav just wasn't wearing any sunglasses at all, including in some bright sun in some photo shoots earlier in the year. And then, he started actually in the end of February. We started seeing more than just Cav in terms of Astana riders running other sunglasses, like wearing Oakleys or wearing Rudy Projects or wearing whatever. So I think this actually probably broke down quite a bit before the news was public and before this sort of quite odd statement from Chicon came out, which, as you say, was sort of from the CEO and discuss sort of the ethics and ethical breach and things like that, all quite rich, again, given the fact that they were in bed with already. And now we end up with this funny situation where Chicon has pulled out entirely from the team. That includes not just sunglasses, that includes like all the bike bags and luggage and some casual wear and a whole bunch of other stuff, which I assume they've probably already delivered and Astana will not be returning.
Is this gonna end up being like a Kyrie Irving type situation where they're just gonna have to tape over all of the logos with like kind of passive aggressive messages to the sponsor? As a, you know, I love fashion and I really love drama, so this is something that really speaks to me. And I think it's really funny that everyone is just like using the word ethics here. It's like, I feel like that's a little heavy-handed for this situation, which is just entirely petty.
2 points. I like that Mark Cavendish chose to wear the stupidest sunglasses in existence over Chicon, the Oakley Kados, which are just a crime against anything.
He is getting paid.
Yeah,
which
I mean,
is worth mentioning.
I don't think I'd wear them if I was being paid. But speaking of ethics, I mean, Chicon are clearly aggrieved. They said that it is very unfortunate that a team would not stand up for what is ethically the right thing to do, honouring the agreement and recognising the significant investments that were made by Chicon. They sent them some bags. we took a strong stance in this case and could not make an exception for one rider. But there's an interesting response from Vinod himself, where he claims that there were no violations of their contractual obligations and they fully respected this agreement. And then he says that despite that, they are still paying them compensation. So one of these things does not match the other. Because they're clearly Alexei Lutsenko is wearing some Oakleys, as is Mark Cavendish. So that seems to me that their contractual obligations have not been met. And if your contractual obligations have been met, then why the hell are you paying Chicon an exit fee?
That's a good question, Ian. I think it's because one or both sides is entirely full of shit, I think is probably...
I think I know where my finger's pointed.
I think the irony of all this is it's another one of those sort of examples where the PR attempts at PR basically make the situation worse for everybody involved. If Chicon had just never said a thing and the sunglasses had just kind of disappeared, then would anyone notice? Like, No,
some people would notice, like those guys on Twitter.
Oh, those guys.
The guys on Twitter, they notice everything. But, like, they would probably continue to use the bags and continue to be, like, photographed using the bags in airports. And I would assume that that's some of the value that Chicon gets out of this.
Counterpoint. At least four journalists now know how their brand name is pronounced because we had to look up a video. And we are all talking about them and have been for about 10 minutes. Not a brand that I've ever cared about. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now all of our listeners know they do. Yeah, they do bike bags and luggage and sunglasses and probably other things. I mean, they're like a pretty ubiquitous brand in some of those areas.
Yeah, bike bags.
Quite a large brand. Yeah, particularly in bike bags, and quite a large brand. And yeah, I mean, just the whole thing just doesn't. Nobody comes away looking particularly honorable at the end of this, and I feel like if played even slightly differently, Chicon could have come away looking quite a bit better.
I was just going to say, with the ongoing sort of Kavastana story, for me, and it's getting closer to resembling the sort of in football, soccer football, it's resembling the sort of PSG story with Mbappe and Messi and like all the sort of pettiness and money things and... You know what I mean, Kaylee? It's just like, it's like icky, but not like in a different way. And it's just all a bit, not sad, but just doesn't fill me with joy, which I think are different things.
Well, I mean, I think that there are some parallels there, right? Because let's be honest, and we don't want to just sort of rag on Cav here, but like he had other options to ride this year, and he picked the one that was going to pay the best, is what our reporting suggests. And so he kind of brings this negative stuff upon himself at that point. Like he's made a decision to trade a bit of extra cash right near the end of his career, which, you know, professional athletes, this is their window to kind of set themselves up, right, for as long as they possibly can. That's why it makes sense that they go chasing money on a frequent basis. But I think if you go chasing the money, you then can't turn around and be annoyed when the very act of you doing that chasing causes issues, which is what's happened here, right? Like the fact that he refuses to just wear the team sponsor sunglasses because he has his own sponsorship and he's making money on the side has created this entire kerfuffle. Again, nobody really comes away from it looking particularly honorable.
Too good. It's like it's good that they didn't make a rap involving the sunglasses.
Thank you for bringing us back, Kate, to the true vibe of this podcast.
Well, I don't think we need to spend any more time on this. It was just a weird story, and one of those stories that kind of wraps up a lot of the weirdness of pro cycling all in one place.
Fashion drama.
You know, you've got convicted doper guy, you've got fashion drama, you've got weird contractual stuff, because contracts don't seem to really mean all that much generally in professional cycling. All these things wrapped up into one nice, neat little Cav Vino shaped package. So, with that,
speaking of gear, I'll
move on to Catalonia. This was a great story that Ian, you dug up and reported overnight. And for anybody who's missed it, there is a sort of a written version of this up on escapecollective.cc. But basically, a couple Latvian writers, including one that is, we should sort of full disclosure, quite close to us here at Escape, ran into trouble because they competed in an event with Russians in it. What exactly is going on?
Yeah, so Tom Skoyansh and Chris Nielands ran afoul of the Latvian Olympic Committee and had their funding cut as a result. Not an enormous amount of funding, but funding nonetheless. And it is kind of an interesting demonstration of the fact that the response from cycling's institutions to the Russian invasion of Ukraine has all of these weird kind of gaps and inconsistencies and areas where things aren't being done in a way that works out for anyone or everyone. So they basically got in trouble for racing on their trade teams against a Russian rider that they didn't know they'd be competing against. And the Russian rider is allowed to compete because he's riding for a trade team. He's not representing his nation in that. And that was enough for the Latvian Olympic Committee to withdraw their annual funding and their monthly stipend. This was later overturned. There was a bit of a hullabaloo in Latvian media, but what I found quite interesting about it was the fact that it wasn't about the money. It was about, for Skoyansh at least, it was about the fact that he felt that in the discourse he'd been targeted as almost being a sympathizer for Russia in competing against a Russian. So, yeah, I think that he was quite wounded by that, to find himself on this blacklist, as he describes it. He says that he felt that our politicians believed that he was not worthy of the ideology and financial support of the Latvian state by withdrawing that funding.
Hmm. Which, I mean, probably just shows a real lack of understanding of how cycling works.
Yeah. Right?
Above all things.
Well, I think that cycling as a team sport, you don't choose who you're riding against. And the Russian riders or Belarusian riders are competing within the guidelines that the IOC and the UCI have handed down. So I think that that's quite interesting. It's good that it was eventually overturned. I think that makes sense. If you can hear a banging noise, there is a small child trying to break into the room. It's very, very early in the morning.
Is it the Russians?
It's not the Russians. It is little Mia. She is giving me a carrot toy. Anyway, to return to the Russians. The Latvian position on this is, I think, informed by the fact that there's these serious sort of Soviet-era hang-ups with their neighbours, Russia and Belarus, and that they've taken steps that are perhaps stronger than other countries, and the IOC and the UCI are trying to play both sides a little bit, I think. I think it's fair to say that. So yeah, I think it's an interesting story, and I think that it is worth considering again, as we have done for an extended period of time since the invasion, whether Mia is trying to
it's hard to take Ian seriously when there's two bunny ears coming up from the bottom of his screen.
What's been happening for people who can't obviously see the call is, if you've ever seen that the online video of the news report where the guy's been interviewed and then the child wanders into the door at the back of the shot, that's just happened, but in podcast form.
But there is no panicked nanny like dragging them out of the room behind
me. No, there's not just true, a child on Ian's lap.
Yeah.
I just like the fact that we saw the bunny ears well before we saw the child. That was really what got me.
And you managed to stay focused and explain it all.
Well, there is more to explain. So I think that, the decision was eventually overturned. And while I think that it's unfortunate that it got to this position, for the Latvian cyclists, and not just cyclists. There's a tennis player that was also stripped of her funding. And again, in tennis, you don't have a choice against who you're competing against in the draw. It's like who won the previous round, whether it got pulled out of the hat that you're going to play against a Russian or a Belarusian. So I think that there are still questions to be had. A bigger point is that I think as the war grinds into a second year, there's kind of an erosion of those kind of hard lines that have been drawn against or drawn under Russian and Belarusian participation in the sport, and the way that the forms that they are allowed to take place, take part in the sport. So there's kind of a renormalization of their position in the peloton. There's little things like they're still not allowed to have, you know, national jerseys and things like that, but there are teams that are starting to push the lines a little bit. Notably, the ethical champions, Astana, Kazakhstan, who have started putting Russian and Belarusian flags on their riders' bikes, again, which is a direct blatant contravention of a UCI ban on those national symbols. So I think that those lines are starting to be blurred in a way that they haven't now that it's been going on for a year. And there's talk from the IOC and the UCI about possibly ways that we could see Russia and Belarus competing in the next Olympics. For Latvia, that is a pretty definitive line that cannot be crossed, and they would boycott the Olympics if that was to happen. And Tom's told me that that's totally fine. Like, that's what the nation would want. So he'd have to, not that he'd have to, he'd be happy to abide by that. But it is, the whole thing's a kind of moral and ethical dilemma, which you would not expect athletes to have to work out how to navigate that situation.
Well, so that's my immediate response to this is like, I mean, it sounds like there were some politicians in Latvia who kind of put this on the shoulders of athletes when really it should be on the shoulders of the organizations, the UCI and the IOC. But everything that they've ever done points to them eventually acquiescing to allowing Russians to be in the Olympics, for example. There's little to convince me that Russia will not be, you know, at the Paris Olympics, for example. And that's just putting the onus on decision making and also kind of the blame in the wrong places, which is the really unfortunate thing about this whole story. And I'm glad it was sort of rectified in the end, but it's still a big deal for people like Tom's, who, you know, when national media is talking about this sort of thing. So.
And it also speaks to the conflicts that exist, I think, because the UCI is not going to take steps beyond what the IOC will, because, I mean, they're just not going to do that. David Lapartien is an IOC member. He's not going to rock the boat. It's kind of hopeless to expect that international institutions like the UCI will do something that, you know, a lot of people would probably see as the right thing to do, because they're going to stand by their Olympic principles of political neutrality. And I kind of understand that they're put between a bit of a rock and a hard place, but I don't know. Like, you'll be shocked to learn that my request for comment on whether Astana is breaking any rules or doing anything that they shouldn't was not responded to. The UCI have continued their year and a half long streak of not responding to requests for comment from me.
Ian, Abby has messaged me twice in the past 2 weeks boasting about her responses from the UCI when she's gone to them for comment.
Well, I know that I've changed email address, so I now know that this is personal. It's not just that I've been put on the block list. This is
that's always reassuring to know.
Yeah, I've sailed through to an inbox and been ignored.
Honestly, that's baller.
Well, and I actually don't even who's running press. We don't need to say their name on air here, but There was recently a request from Ronan to for a bunch of sort of tech related things, and now generally those requests go to Mick Rogers, who is kind of running all those sort of things at the UCI right now, and the request was, came back basically like, can you please send this through normal channels? Can you go through our press office? Now, part of the reason why we don't go through the press office is because they just ignore us almost every single time. And the whole thing is frankly absurd from a governing body that in theory should be somewhat, I don't know, beholden to the whims of the cycling public for whom we are in theory speaking. Anyway, that's a bit of a tangent there, but I think it's just ridiculous that they're not just emailing you back. I mean, it's not hard to just say no comment, right? Mm. Like, at least respond. And whoever's running press at the UCI these days seems to be clamping down even in other areas, even in the sort of non-Ian areas, which is not a good, it's not a good thing for the sport. It's not a good thing for cycling. It's not a good thing for journalism. And, well, I have no problem calling it out in a podcast like this.
Yeah, I agree. There has been an erosion of transparency. And I think if you look at the website, there are documents that you cannot find there that you were able to find a couple of years ago. It has become a little bit more of a closed shop. And I think that's unfortunate.
I would argue that's true across the entire sport. It was only like accelerated by the pandemic so that like you can't get access to anything anymore. They just use that to close everyone off from everything.
I mean, there's a million examples of that, and we don't want to bore people out there with essentially our problems, but our problems, because you consume the media that we create, are kind of the audience's problems too, right? Like from important things like them not responding to Ian's emails about very important subjects to the very sort of basic, where let's use like Roubaix, for example, which is coming up in a couple of weeks. At the end of Roubaix, we used to be able to just, you know, everyone just would fall off their bikes and lay in the grass, and we would walk up with recorders and we would talk to whoever we want. And now there's a big fence, and the only people that can talk to the riders that they want to talk to are television. And so it really hampers our ability to bring you the things, the interesting things that the audiences want and that the sport needs to grow. So yeah, lots and lots of examples like that of just tiny erosions in access and transparency that have happened over the last couple of years. And I frankly don't see it ever going back, because if you look at other major sports, it's even worse, right? If you go to like, you know, European or British football, way worse. Access is so narrow and so closely defined, and you never get anybody outside of that very sort of stage managed kind of moment. I would imagine that cycling will just continue down that path. There's no reason for the powers that be to ever take it back the other direction.
We're going to need to get to the bottom of the riders stopping the Garmins on the finish line though, somehow. That will be done.
Well, we have 10 days in Belgium coming up, Johnny. You and me, we're going to get to the bottom of this most important story. I want to move on to Catalonia, and I want to talk Remco and Roglic and a little bit of actual bike racing here. It's been an awesome, we've only had two stages so far. Both have ended up being these sort of mano-a-mano battle between Roglic and Remco, with a little bit of Giulio Ciccone in there as well.
Can I segue quickly into, you mentioned Giulio Ciccone, a man who is known for throwing his sunglasses into the crowd at any opportunity. He did not throw his sunglasses on this occasion.
Oh, yes, he didn't. Now, you'd expect that Skicom are lining up to become his personal sponsor.
The sacrificial sunglass sponsor?
Yeah, from a team and rider and star rider who won't wear your sunglasses to one who will throw them away as soon as they get even close to the finish line.
This is the greatest podcast ever made.
I actually want to talk about something slightly different from Giulio Ciccone's sunglasses and throwing habits. And I want to bring up a bit of a pet peeve. So at the finish line of every stage of Catalonia so far, we have seen this interesting thing, which I don't recall happening all that much a couple years ago, but seems to have become something of a fad, which is riders crossing the finish line, and before they do anything, they hit stop on their Garmin. Now, this is whatever. Okay, you're coming across the line in 55th place. You hit pause. You know, you do your coach a favor because they don't have to go and find the place to trim it down and all the rest. But what kind of got me this week was when Roglic did this instead of celebrating a victory. And I don't really fully understand why. In fact, I wrote a whole article about me not really understanding why he did this. Now, as our in-house Roglic whisperer, Kate, I was wondering if you could shed any light on why this might be. I understand that you haven't spoken with him in some time, and so this is going to be pure speculation, but I would like to know perhaps why, after winning a stage of Catalunya, which is not a tiny, tiny, tiny race, over top of a world champion, who finished right behind him in Remco, in Evenepoel, instead of sticking any hands in the air, which we know he can do, he can ride no-handed, he sort of stays hands on the bars and then blips a little button on his Garmin and rolls away into the waiting scrum.
Yeah, it's hard to what say. I think you should really compare. Okay, so the Garmin thing is one thing, but what I think is also interesting is that this pairing between the Garmin thing and then he gets up on stage and does the telemark. And so I think that part of me, like, I think if we want to just go with, like, baseline benefit of the doubt, like, nothing's going on here. There's no subtext to this whatsoever. I think he's just in the zone, maybe. And, like, maybe he's just dead and not thinking that much and just shuts it off. And then, you know, but winning, I don't know. I really get this impression, and I did when he was at Tirreno, that he really just means business these days. I mean, I don't see a lot of... He really just is digging in there. I mean, there's not a lot of joking around. There's not a lot of interviews. There's not the only thing he does is this telemark, and that's like his public face. And I really think that if you're Roglic, right, and you had the season that you had last year, which was, let's be real, like kind of mid by Roglic standards, and, you know, you just want to prove yourself before the Grand Tour where you really are on the world stage. You're just trying to get your form in there. I mean, it could just be that he's just in his own head and, you know, isn't thinking. Maybe he doesn't want to draw attention to himself. I mean, after his exit last year, though that's also pure speculation. But I really think he's just focused. All of this just seems to me like it's some kind of appetizer before the main course. And so he's not spending some. I think he's won both of these races before. He's not really spending that much time. It's not so unique anymore, which sounds kind of, you know, sad or depressing. But I totally kind of get it. I mean, if you are going through something, like Roglic seems really shaken last year. If you're kind of going through something and really just trying to get back on the horse, this kind of behavior, I think, makes sense to me just as a human being.
The take of a lot of our commenters on my story was that it was just some form of humility or like professionalism, which I think is a really interesting way to think about it. There's some other athletes in the past. Barry Sanders is one that was brought up in the comment section and one that I had forgotten about but would agree with, who was sort of notorious. He's an American football player who would score a touchdown and just hand the ball to the ref, right? So like no celebration, no spiking the ball, no doing a big dance, just like, yep, that's what I'm here to do, that's what I'm paid to do, and that's what I just did, right? And I think that that's actually kind of a cool thing, because my initial response to this was like, that's lame, like you just want to race. And I know that Roglic has bigger fish to fry, but you just want to race that most of the rest of the peloton, it would be like a career highlight, right? And to kind of respect that, I feel like you got to at least stick a hand in the air and pretend you're excited. But the other way to think about it is this sort of humility angle and professionalism angle where... Yeah, he's you know, he wants to win Grand Tours, and Catalonia is great, but it's not a highlight of his season, and he's kind of just that good.
Yeah, he's focused.
Yeah.
I think at least it's better than like a manufactured celebration where they're just putting it on for the crowds. You know, I think that's, if you're ranking sort of finish line actions, that would come below just stopping your Garmin. And like you saw it today with when Evenepoel beat Roglic, his celebration was pure sort of like relief, and it was genuine, which I guess also shows. I think it was because he was like he'd been trying to drop him for, you know, past 3 days, but it shows a sort of power imbalance there where I think Evenepoel still has everything to prove. I don't know, well, maybe there's more on his shoulders than with Roglic. What I will say about Roglic's Garmin stop and the Telemark is that if he goes all in with the Garmin stop and starts doing that, the Garmin stop on the podium, then he can never celebrate a victory again. That'd be great.
Yeah. I really don't think it's that complicated. Yeah, I would say either he's cooked, he's focused, or he's just being a professional. I don't think there's any like weird Freudian subtext to this.
He's saving his emotion for more of those promotional videos for Morton's or whatever it was.
His acting leaves something to be desired, and maybe that's the whole point, is that he's just showing us exactly what he's feeling, and what he's feeling in that particular moment is I need to stop my Garmin.
I'm done. Yeah, I'm finished.
I feel that most of the time.
I feel this way. Okay, first of all, this reminds me, A, of my husband, who is the exact same way. We're going on this nice bike ride. You know, we're having fun. We're talking, whatever. We're just having a nice time. He comes home. He's like, immediately stops the Garmin. That's it. He's like, oh, I have to upload this to Strava. Like, immediately. It's like, who are you? Roglic?
I mean, if you wait too long to stop the Garmin, it'll decrease your average speed, your average power, all the numbers that make yourself make you feel good about yourself.
I stopped using a Garmin because it made me feel bad about myself. But anyways,
I think in the was it third stage of Catalonia? Then second stage of Catalonia. This is yesterday. Ciccone wins, and behind him is Roglic and Evenepoel.
Both on the
both
Garmin.
Both of them stop their Garmin.
So good.
right as they cross the line. So you got Ciccone with his arms up, and the other two just not even paying attention. Like, I gotta find this little button on my computer.
I feel like...
like I care so little about Ciccone winning that I'm just gonna look down and...
I really feel like this is starting for you to be like, you know those images that boomers share of like, kids on their phones in art museums and they get all upset. Like, this is like your picture like that, Kayla. Yes.
That sounds about right.
This is your kid these days, except Roglic is 33. But anyways.
What if it wasn't about the Garmin and they were just like putting their heads down because they were expecting the Ciccone sunglass toss and they were taking evasive action?
I'm moving us on from Roglic. We've discussed the Garmin thing. It's a me problem. I don't think it's a him problem. I'm pretty sure it's a me problem, and I'm going to have to just get over it. But also, they all have coaches, and they can trim the file later.
Do you, every time you see it happen, just do the Telemark and see if it makes you feel better.
Just don't know what to do sometimes.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? It's like gives them something to do when they cross the line.
If I won a bike race, I would just scream as loud as possible. Like, just the loudest possible scream. That's the only thing I could think of doing. Because I definitely can't ride without holding the handlebar, so.
That's what a lot of them do. Like, I've been in a fair number of finish lines in my day. And even pros that have won quite a bit of stuff, they, you know, you still get some pretty loud celebrations. That's why Roglic's complete, I should say, it wasn't just, he hasn't celebrated three of the last four wins, like not a single hand off the bars, just a poke of the Garmin. That's it.
He's afraid of jinxing himself.
It's weird. How do you not celebrate winning a professional bike race? I don't anyway, we're moving on.
Anyways, yeah, sorry for dragging this out.
No need to apologize. I want to move on to a slightly more serious topic. Bruges de Pana was this morning. Johnny, you caught up with that race. And, well, there's some things that we can take out of it going forward, right?
Yeah, it was very exciting. You had the final... I tuned in because loads of people on Twitter were just being like, this is great. But then with like... screen captures of like very rainy, wet weather. So I was like, what's this? Something. So all the groups along the road. It ended up with Yves Lampaert, Frederik Friesen, I think, from Lotto Destiny, Olav Kooi, and Jasper Philipsen, who does wear the Oakley, what are they called, Ian? The Oakley, the
Kato.
One.
Kato.
Yeah. And he looks amazing in them. He looks like he's about to shoot laser beams out of his eyes. And So you had Yves Lampaert sort of there tagging on because Fabio Jakobsen was in the group behind. But then very late on, they sort of decided this isn't going to work. Yves Lampaert, it's up to you. And instead of sort of attacking early, like when a crosswind hit or something like that, he decided, I'm going to sprint against these two sprinters. And it didn't go well, but it was sort of entertaining to see him or the team car make that decision. And Frederik Friesen also tried to open up his sprint, and it was like he was sprinting through custard. And Jasper Philipsen didn't even really get out of his saddle to like take the wheel. Also because it was a horrible day out. And Jasper Philipsen won. But the main like sort of takeaway from it, and I want to get people's takes on this, is anytime like Soudal Quickstep don't win a race in Belgium in the spring, it's like the sky is falling. But there are many riders and many teams who have many good riders, and even though they usually do well in their own races, I just think it's a tired take of like disaster at Soudal Quickstep. You know, they're not going to win a race.
Well, I'm just looking forward to the Patrick Lefebvre article, the op-ed where he's just blasting Lampaert for no good reason.
Do you remember either last season or the season before when they, I think it must have been before the Tour of Flanders, where they, for their pre-race press conference, it was like hosted as if it was a TV chat show, and they had all the riders sat on benches, and then also Patrick Lefebvre there, but he had like a really nasty like cold or flu, so he was just like spluttering throughout all of it while also like sort of giving the riders like looks and like saying things between the lines. But yeah, it must have still been marketing, I guess, that like whatever the team does, you either have to celebrate them or just talk shit about them in the Flemish newspapers. I don't know.
I mean, the funny thing about Soudal Quickstep, and can we just call them Quickstep because that's easier and that's the one that's the name that has basically stayed forever.
You might get a message, Kaylee, from people.
From your man?
Sometimes. It's happened to me in the past. Just a warning.
I don't know if he has my phone number. I think we're all right. So I'm gonna call it Quickstep. The funny thing about this team for me is they have 15 victories already this year, right? There are teams. Let's go back to like EF a couple years ago that went 18 months or 2 years without a single World Tour victory. So we talk about this team as being a failure when they haven't won some of the things that they've won before, in particular some of these major spring races, which I'll point out that we haven't even gotten through yet. But it's as sort of by any other definition, the team's doing all right this year. That said, their major names are all underperforming right now. There's no question in my mind that is the case, with the exception of Remco Evenepoel, right? I mean, Alaphilippe has been almost nowhere. He has one victory at Van Ardèche. Tim Merlier has been all right, but their sort of major classics crew hasn't really done much at all and doesn't really look like they're going to be able to do much at all going into sort of the next part of the season. I feel like, I think one of the weird things for me is it feels like Arnaud Delys should be on that team. Like, as granted, he's a Walloon, but as a Belgian, and sort of like the next Boonin is always on Quickstep, right? That's like how this works. And the fact that he's not is kind of confusing to my brain, and also means that team, you look down the roster, and it's a totally different makeup than it was even last year. They've lost a fair amount of classics firepower. They don't have the next Tom Boonin on their squad. They've got Remco and climbers and sort of stage hunter types of various forms. I don't expect them to be the classics team that we know them as for the last decade.
Yeah, and if they had continued to invest in classics guys and not signed climbers for Evenepoel, then you'd have had everyone shouting at them for doing that. So either way, maybe that's just the thing. Maybe people just enjoy criticizing whatever they do. Is this what empathy feels like or sounds like?
I'm not like a Mappe historian or anything, but like, has there ever been like a time when that team focused primarily on the Grand Tours aside from the sprints? Like, I can't think of any.
No, I'm sitting here thinking.
I think the pause probably means no.
Yeah, I mean.
So I mean, it's a new thing for them, right? So maybe like, instead of being blasting them all the time for, you know, not winning Brugge de Panne or whatever. I mean, this is a very different shift for them as a team in like their whatever long history, fractured as it may be. And it's actually quite risky. And I think it's rather rare to see teams that assemble for either Grand Tours or Classics now take on or switch those roles. I mean, I would need to do some reading, but yeah, it's just kind of interesting to see that such a change in direction.
Well, they still have most of the Classic season to kind of prove us wrong here, but again, we haven't seen anything from the riders that they do have left that could do something like a Casper Asgreen, right? Casper was just routinely at the pointy end of things for the last couple of years, and I haven't seen much of him at all. He was like 36th at Milan-San Remo. Granted, it's Milan-San Remo. It's just only the first of these major races, right? So we still have a week and a bit to Flanders and 2 weeks and a bit to Roubaix. He could be coming around right now. We've seen how fast these guys can go from 95% to 100%. I think Mathieu van der Poel, Tirreno to, or Strade Bianche, for example, to MSR, Milan-San Remo. That is a pretty good example of sort of like, I shouldn't say how quickly they can get up to 100%, but I think probably the difference between 98 and 100 for even a rider like Mathieu van der Poel, where the level is so high across the peloton right now that if you're off even a little bit, you're essentially a non-factor, which is where like Casper Asgreen has been. But once you hit that level, he could be right back up there when we get to Flanders in 10 days. We got a couple other little news hits we want to chat about today. A very brief Nairo Quintana update. Who wants to give me the Nairo Quintana update?
Johnny.
Johnny does.
Just, we had someone get in touch saying they'd spotted, a trusted, reliable source, saying they'd spotted Nairo Quintana out motorpacing in Andorra on a BMC wearing Rafa kit. So what's happened is that after not finding a team, he's moved to London, started working for one of the big four accountancy firms, and is now taking a well-deserved holiday.
Remco Deloitte Quintana. Or is he more of a KPMG kind of guy?
You know what? I'm actually pleasantly surprised that I don't know the big four firms well enough to complete that analogy. I'm going to take that as a point of pride.
I have a chat about a friend about the... We have like lots of jokes about the big four accounting firms for some reason. Anyways... Being my friend is a chore.
I like, Johnny, that you also pointed out that he's got a nice line in like personal embroidered casual wear.
Mm.
You rustled up from somewhere a picture of him wearing a Nairo branded shirt, looking extremely crisp.
Yeah, I think
and
he
brand compliant for himself.
Fondos. Yeah, it's like he's got the little like lightning blue N logo. But also, whenever I see a picture like that, like I can't remember what it was when I was at those end of season Italian races. I can't remember what brand it was, but it was like jeans with a bike, like a bike team on them. I think I sent it to both of you. And as soon as I see something like that, for some reason, the Pavlovian response is to send it to you. I'm not sure you've ever expressed an interest in all these themed.
It seems like the kind of thing that I'd like.
Yeah, you should.
Was it the Trek jeans?
Sorry?
Trek Segafredo has like a team jean sponsor.
Yeah, I feel like it was like, one of the smaller like, Italian team.
But I mean, that would also make sense. But yeah, the Trek ones are sort of like a tight Belgian.
Ew.
Belgian cut, I think.
Oh,
is
wow.
Ew.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a scene.
I do like when riders have their own personal monogram. I'm just looking at some off-brand Peter Sagan basketball shoes with his...
An Ian Trailer
sort of vaguely
classic.
Fascist-looking sort of symbol.
Yeah,
on
that
it.
Logo is
yeah, that's
is suspect.
Maybe problematic. Yeah.
So at least Nairo's.
Does
Roglic have a little monogram?
Yes, he is always wearing his clothes. He used to like wear like weird thrift store combos, which I found very endearing. And now he just wears his like store's clothes, his Roglic store clothes.
The thing is, they must spend so much money on getting the people to design these logos.
And I know who, the guy
but
who
I want
does
to know
it.
Who's wearing the merch. Who's like, who's buying the merch?
Slovenians are buying the merch. You see it everywhere.
Really?
Yeah, that's a... I won't divulge. But anyways,
Well, you can't do that.
You can't do that.
No. Cut that.
All right, we're going to return to the merch drama.
Cut that. It's off the record. I should not have said something. I had a beer. But I'll tell you later. I'll tell you after.
Just bleep it. Okay.
On the membership Discord.
But yeah, Quintana. I forgot where we were. Quintana is back in Europe for one, training. So seems determined to get himself back onto a team of some description at some point, which sounds flimsy, but I guess
he's going to be a gravel privateer.
Well, that's also the thing as well. Because in November when it was all sort of kicking off, he uploaded Instagram stories of him out on his mountain bike in like the cold and the rain. So maybe that was training for that. And also I looked up because he came fifth at the Roubaix stage at last year's tour. But I double checked and that wasn't the day of one of his tramadol positives. That was the day after. So we can be sure that Roubaix performance was tip top and organic. Yeah.
Mm. Nairo at Unbound. What do we think?
God, please.
That sounds great.
Quintana, sounds fantastic. Quintana versus Ian Boswell in a sprint for the win.
Sounds just fantastic.
Choice.
I would love it. All right, everybody.
Yep.
Thanks for joining today. I have to mention, and I will continue to mention, if you are not already a member of Escape Collective, head over to escapecollective.cc. It is the reason why all of this exists. And that is not an exaggeration. We have not taken a single ad dollar since launching this thing. That isn't to say that we won't in the future. We're not anti-ads. We're just anti-annoying or sneaky ads, really. But as of right now, it's all on members. And that means that everybody who signs up is absolutely vital to us being able to continue doing this, which means that you keep getting this podcast and all the rest of the Escape Collective podcasts. So escapecollective.cc, head over and sign up. Ian, Johnny, Kate, thanks for joining today.
Thank you. It's been fun.
Hola. Yeah.
Enjoyed it a lot.
We'll be back next week with another episode of Placeholders. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Kaylee, don't forget we got that SkiCon meeting in half an hour.
Guys, so I have to show you what I found at a thrift store in Slovenia today. You guys are going to love this real quick.
Okay.
Let's see.
It's so important. It's so important. At a thrift store.
This could be anything.
Carrera jeans.
Ho, ho, ho.
Sheila, check this out. It is Velcro.
Oh my God.
Yeah, Carrera jeans.
Can you describe the material for me?
I'm pretty sure this is from the late 80s. It was manufactured by some company called Moa Sport.
They still make stuff.
It looks like a lab coat.
It is made of something. I have no idea. It feels like polyester, honestly.
Highly flammable.
Yes. And also there's some really... really great rubber in here to keep it. Yeah, it's a gilet. It's like a long sleeve gilet. Like tear it open. Right. I look kind of cool.
So it's like a rain jacket. It's an old like 80s Carrera rain jacket.
Yes, I found it in a thrift store today for €10. I look pretty cool.
Superb. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, 10 out of 10.
But the only way that could be improved is if it was like the denim appearance.
I know. Yeah.
I had some Carrera Uber shoes and they were so good.
I'm really fascinated by like the rubber all around the collar. I'm guessing it must be a rain jacket. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's the Velcro is so genius. Why don't we do that anymore?
I mean, I can't imagine it's particularly waterproof at this
point.
It's
also like not particularly warm either, or waterproof. It just looks cool.
It's really transitioned into its vibes phase, I think is really where it's at.
Well, yeah, it's transitioned into being worn by some twee fucking journalist asshole. Yeah, I guess, sorry. I had to go, I had to show somebody that.
I think it's fantastic, and I might cut up that as our little soft opening for this.
especially the twee fucking journalist line. I think that's that's important to make it into the finished product.
That definitely has to get in.